I have never worked for myself. I've never started or had my own business. My experience is such that I've always been in the employ of someone else, a private business or a branch of government, or as I am now, an employee of what's generally thought of as a charitable organization, a nonprofit, and we are certainly a nonprofit, but which is, as you all know, a subversive organization whose express purpose is the overthrow of the present world order. Please don't tell anyone, it could hurt our tax status. So how many people here have owned your own home business, or even a small or a large business? That's a pretty good number. While I've not done that, this is the call of my wonderful and entrepreneurial son-in-law. And yes, my dad did start and own his own business. My wife has dabbled a bit. And so I've glimpsed a little of what's required to do this and to do it successfully. Now, your mileage may vary, but I think it's far more challenging to work for yourself than to work for someone else. I've had two careers, I've had two formal professions, I've done a number of jobs, and frankly, I figure it was far simpler and less stressful to be an employee. Little known fact. I once worked as a maintenance man for a hotel for a while. I was completely miscast in the role. I had no clue as to what I was doing, but I picked up some knowledge and experience that's been useful to this very day. I mean, if you need someone to get a beer bottle out of a toilet, I am your guy. I do note that this has not been a big problem here in the past, but somehow I fear a rash of this in the future now that I've admitted that. But here's the thing. Colin, don't you dare. He just gave me that look, you know? But here's the thing. I would come to work first thing in the morning. I'd punch my card at the start of the day, do the jobs that were assigned to me, and some of them were kind of odd. I would punch out at the end of the day, and then I'd go home, and I'd not think another thing about work. I tried to work hard when I was there, despite my cluelessness, but when I was done, I was done. You'd probably be relieved to know that when I worked in the emergency room, I was less clueless. Yeah, that's a comfort, isn't it? I was much more in my elements of both skill and inclination, but nonetheless, rare was the day that I took my work home with me. Rare was the day when I went home and fretted or second-guessed myself or worried about the work I did. About every 6 months or so, I realized that I would carry something home with me. It would be a disturbing image that I'd seen. I'm not sure it's possible to avoid that in that line of work, specifically in that venue, because human beings can do terrible things to one another. But honestly, to survive and thrive in that work, it required some ability to set things aside and carry on, trusting those you've passed your work on to. At shift end, it was done, at least for 12 hours. For my dad, of course, his work was never done. It wasn't 9 to 5 or 7 to 7, it was 24 hours a day. And even when the business was doing well, it was something that consumed his waking and his sleeping. He was always on call, always keeping an eye on the business horizon, constantly dealing with employees and customers, and usually employees were more difficult than customers. And it was always trying to improve and grow and find efficiencies. Though when I worked in the operating room, I did have a similar kind of on-call experience. While I was there, I carried a beeper every other day during the week and every second weekend. And I realized that being on call pretty much meant I was working all the time. It was literally always with me, on my hip. And it influenced all my other activities, and I found it to be rather trying. It's one of the reasons I responded to the call to pastoral ministry, because, hey, it's only 1 or 2 hours a week. And even then, pretty much anyone with a Bible and the gift of the gab can do it, you know, like it's walk in the park. Yeah, that's not wholly true, but in some ways, the line of work that I get to do, and I mean that when I say get to do, because I really do love this thing. But in many ways, it's a bit like owning your own business in that it's difficult to just put down and separate from the rest of your life. it just kind of goes home with you. And if you're not careful, it can go on vacation with you as well. And even the most disciplined and professional clergy, you know, the ones who say, it's my day off, I will not be taking this call. That kind of disciplined clergy. Even they'll usually own up to the challenge of not taking it with you. And note that this isn't a complaint. It's just what it is. And so we all need to find some healthy ways to deal with this reality. And most of us do just fine eventually. No, the danger in this particular job is assuming that I'm the owner. A dollar for every time I've heard someone say, so, you're a reverend. I don't really like that appellation. It's not really an accurate one. But anyway, so you're a reverend. How big is your church? Your church. Happened to me last week. And by the way, the temptation to lie to that question, to inflate figures, is so strong. Because it's my church, right? Those numbers become the gauge of my success or failure. So we clergy tend to not like to be asked that question for two reasons. First of all, it feels a bit too intimate too soon. You know, like it's a bit like kissing on the first date. Or that's a bit quaint, isn't it? But if I went somewhere else, it would be inappropriate. So, you know, anyway. But it feels a bit too intimate. It's kind of like a personal question. Secondly, we tend not to like it because of what it does to us, because it tempts us to exaggerate. The other thing I'll hear is, oh yeah, I've heard of your church, and then they'll confuse us with St. Mark's. But again, it's your church. Of course, my favorite was the time when I heard someone refer to me as Pastor Stephen, who's at St. Philip's United Church. I mean, that ain't on. St. Philip's. Really? And, you know, according to our denominational polity, I'm not even really a member of this congregation. And Diane, who's starting off as a member of the congregation, she's now about to be ordained, so she's actually losing her membership here. And as of June 3rd, will simply be a member of Comox Nanaimo Presbytery, at least until January 1st, 2019, when I have now been advised that she'll belong to something presently called Region 1, which has that romantic ring of some old Soviet-style industrial district, comrades. I've been assured that we're going to come up with something better, but you know. Anyway, I digress. Despite all that, time and position and relationships and affection, it really creates some strong sense of connection, right? And there's always the danger of slipping into thinking that I have some ownership of this place. Not that this is only a temptation for the resident clergy. For those occupying other positions and providing forms of management, for that matter, simply attending here on a semi-regular basis, that can lead all manner of people into thinking that they own the place, possess the institution, the church. And that leads us to say, yeah, it's my church, in a kind of a proprietary kind of way. No. All of us, we are strictly in sales and service. Ownership lies somewhere else. Today's gospel reading is a part of Jesus' commentary on one of his I am statements. One of those seven kinds of I am statements you'll find, or sayings you'll find in the Gospel of John. You will remember most, if not all, of these. He says, I am the bread of life, I am the light of the world, I am the sheep gate, I am the resurrection and the life, I am the way, the truth, and the life, I am the vine. And of course, in today's passage, it's I am the good shepherd. You'll also remember that this chapter follows a section in which Jesus heals the man born blind, which leads the now sighted man to an extended debate with the community and the religious authorities. And by the time that episode concludes, it's obvious that the church leaders, who assumed that they could see perfectly, were in fact blind, to what was right before them. It's a story that's important to remember when we get ourselves convinced that we fully understand the church. Oh, and that's especially a problem for clergy. But perhaps for all who belong to the church, who dare to think that we own the church. Because there are dynamics going on here, things that God is doing that I have a hunch we will never, ever know. Not in our lifetime. What we do today may be having an effect on what will be happening in 150 years. Jesus keeps talking to this rather hostile audience, and then in chapter 10 he starts describing his role in such a way that puts himself at the center at their religious life. And it's shocking to his listeners what he's saying here. He makes reference to a shepherd, one who gathers and protects the sheep. He who knows them intimately, calls them by name, speaks of a gatekeeper and a gate, and makes further reference to thieves and robbers who've misled the flock, assuring them that he's actually the gate, and he's come to ensure that they have abundant life. And then at the beginning of our reading today, he says, "I am the good shepherd." And he says he's so committed to the sheep that he'll give up his life for them. Okay, time out. We were circling this a bit last week, weren't we? What would you give up your life for? I think it would have to be pretty important. You'd have to be completely committed. You'd have to love whatever you were about a whole bunch to act that way, I'd say. When I say love, I'm not merely referring to the feeling, but rather to the love we read about in the New Testament that's about placing the well-being of the other before yours. This is really ownership on steroids, to be willing to die for the flock. And then Jesus throws the hired hands, those non-owner but employed shepherds, pretty much under the bus. Because everyone knows, he says, that they'll run at the first sign of danger. Now, as a hired shepherd, as a perpetual employee, I'd like to protest this just a little. Because I've really tried hard to do my best. Seen a few wolves in my time. I've tried not to flee in too much of a hurry. Tried to put up at least a little bit of a fight, at least most of the time. I've applied for and been given various jobs, and in pretty much every case, the job description has been fairly clear. I do this, I do that, and for that I get paid this much money. Nowhere does it say I have to offer up my life as the handyman for the Stockman's Motor Hotel. Nowhere was I to said that I was to give up my life for E.B. Horseman, the electrical wholesaler, or any of the jobs I've had. When I was in the hospital in moments of high drama and trauma, it was nowhere written in the contract or expected that I would lay down my life for my patient. I'd live with chicken feed for being on call, and it was really a pittance. I'd stay hours after my shift ended if the situation required it. I would take some risks even. I was physically assaulted more than a few occasions when I was working in the emergency room. But I've never had so much skin in the game that dying was an expectation. So I'd just like to put in a good word for hired hands, for hired shepherds. But then again, it's wholly possible that Jesus wasn't disparaging those people at all. I think that Jesus was simply clarifying something. Though some may run, he, the good shepherd, he's never, ever going to abandon the flock. And even in death, he won't abandon the flock. Even the flock that will be tempted and will surely even succumb to the temptation to scatter. You ever scattered? I know that temptation. And sadly, I've given in to that fear. I've not stood for the gospel. I've not stood for Jesus when I know I should have. I know what it's like to scatter. But Jesus says, "I lay down my life in order to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have the power to lay it down, and I have the power to take it up again." Even in death, Jesus will be faithful in his commitment to his fearful sheep, to us. Standing between us and that which threatens the flock. For he is also the gate. My problem, and I wouldn't be surprised that all of this was your temptation as well. But my problem is sometimes slipping into thinking that the flock is first and foremost my responsibility, that I'm the owner. This happens in churches all the time, I think. This confusion of roles. We also heard the 23rd Psalm this morning. It always ends up accompanying this gospel reading in the lectionary there, of natural companions. And we heard something similar in the Psalm. Who's the owner? Who's the shepherd? Well, the Lord is my shepherd, is our shepherd. The shepherd guides and provides and protects all the days of our lives and forever. This shepherd is a really good one. If you were to look up the Greek word translated as good in John's phrase, the good shepherd, you'd see it's the word kalos. And you'd see that good does not fully describe it. It means quite literally, beautiful. Isn't that neat? The beautiful shepherd. Remember we talked about beauty some months back. Beauty, according to Thomas Aquinas, is that which when seen pleases. We behold this good and beautiful shepherd. Pay attention to this stained glass we have here. Some members of this flock kindly left it for us years ago as a reminder. Witness this good and this beautiful shepherd. And our breath is taken away at how he is so right for the work he does, for the love he embodies and demonstrates. This shepherd is so kind. He is so good. Hence, imperfect, not so beautiful people like you and me. Not owners, but hired hands, as it were. We're drawn to this good and beautiful shepherd. We cannot show him off enough. Introduce people to him, they are drawn to him. And as we come close, this most remarkable thing happens. This happens to the flock. We start to look and act a little like him. And so when the wolf comes, we flee less often. Find the courage to linger a little longer. Take some risks. Perhaps even risk our lives or stand for things that might make us less popular. Housing for the poor, for example. But things that we know are near to the heart of God. Near to the heart of the good and the beautiful shepherd who has promised us a home with him forever. Oh, thanks be to God. Amen.